For too many people, life has just become too hard, right? It's too much of a struggle. The big challenge for Labour and this government is to genuinely show that government as it is can be a force for good in people's lives.
Because we can't go on like this anymore. Things will have to be done differently.
Otherwise, that anti-system sentiment is just going to overwhelm it as people go, this isn't working. If you ask Britons to describe the country in a word, now, the word they're most likely to use is broken.
Shattered Britain or broken Britain, or you might say this country's doesn't it?
Shattered Britain speaks to this idea that we are about to face some serious civil disobedience.
Well, I would urge a bit of caution.
A genuine threat to public order.
So when we ask people who is benefiting the most for this government, big businesses, the rich and immigrants come out as the top three.
Yikes.
The rich are growing their wealth very rapidly and it's acting like a black hole in society. It's sucking the wealth away from the middle class, from the working class, from the government.
There's definitely a group of young men who think the system no longer works for people like me anymore.
I mean, immigration is kind of the subject of the day. There doesn't seem to be a conversation around cohesion.
You're entirely right to focus on integration.
This issue is driving a wedge between people. It's looking increasingly hard to find a middle ground.
When you ask about a whole raft of other policies, workers' rights, renters' rights, the sewage stuff, Great British Energy.
Come on, keep listening to them, keep listening to them, keep listening.
No, minimum wage, yeah. Hugely popular.
Do you think that Nige really wants it? We've been listening to you, the audience, and I've heard that there needs to be a bit more of a narrative arc to some of our unconstrained conversations. So here we are trying it for the very first time. Okay, in the first half of this discussion with Luke Trill, of all people, big ups, more in common. The number one pollsters. Are you mad? Industry, have you ever had that before, Luke?
No, never. This is my best intro ever.
We're going to be discussing their new report, Shattered Britain, which is as crazy as it sounds, and the implications it has for Labour and their strategy ahead of the next election. That will be the discussion for the first half.
And then in the second half, I'll try my best not to be swiveling around. I've heard I swivel a bit too much, and I think Freddie does as well.
No comment.
but we'll be talking about disillusionment, the state of democracy, the rise of a new left-wing party, what that means for young people, what that means for democracy, just what that means for Britain as we go forward. So welcome, Luke.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having me. That's the best intro I've had to any appearance I think
Luke's
I've ever done.
Luke's not betrayed that we did it once before, but here we go. We're rolling now. So Luke, Shattered Britain, you know, this huge report you guys have come up with, it's got a new segmentation of the electorate to seven different types of voters. I mean, firstly, I guess you're capturing the energy and the mood of the country right now, but could you please explain to us who are these seven voters?
Yeah, absolutely. So we did this report because we wanted to do a kind of mapping of, I guess, the different tribes of Britain and to understand the fault lines that separate them. Because I think we've known for a long time that the sort of traditional left-right axis actually doesn't work very well. You know, it gives you something, but it doesn't give you the whole picture. And what we found through the research was that there were sort of seven or eight new fault lines that really define public attitudes and I guess how people want to define how people want to go about fixing broken Britain. Because if there's something all Britons are pretty much united on, it's the fact that the country hasn't been on a good track for quite some time. And so these fault lines are things like, for instance, whether you think we can improve Britain by preserving and making our institutions better, or, and this was the actual poll question we asked, we should just burn them all down. Whether you trust established news sources to give us the answers, or you want to find your own truth online. Are they simple problems we face with simple common sense solutions, or are they complex, requiring experts? And also questions around, is diversity strengthening the UK or is it weakening it? Is free speech an absolute or do we need to temper it? And so we bring these fault lines together to produce what we call the British Seven segments. And these segments, I'm sure listeners, viewers will have seen segmentations before. What's different about these segments is that rather than being based on demographics or who you vote for, they're based on a series of social psychology questions which get at those fault lines.
So like a bit like a personality test.
Exactly. Yeah. It's sort of like politics meets Myers-Briggs, but much more scientific.
So this is just something you should be doing before your first date, to be like, oh, you're a progressive activist.
Yeah, progressive activist.
I'm an incrementalist left.
Yeah, you're not going to get on. You know, one of you is going to be too impatient. One of you is going to be too cautious. And that's how we come up with the seven.
So who are these seven voters? If you could do one line on each, that would be brilliant.
Okay, so progressive activists, they're the most liberal left of the groups, very passionate, motivated by social justice, want quite radical change. Incrementalist left share a lot of the values of progressive activists, but are much more happier trying to bring about change through our existing system, quite cautious, a little conflict averse, you might say. Established liberals, they're sort of like Cameronite conservatives almost, optimistic, quite socially liberal, also quite economically sort of right-leaning, strong belief in individual agency. We've got a new group who we call skeptical scrollers. This is a group, not swivelers. They have been shaped by the pandemic. They're a group who are quite low trust. They lean younger, get lots of their news online. Typically, you might have called them politically disengaged because they're the least likely to vote, but they're the most likely to share political content online. So they just engage with politics differently. Rooted patriots, this group you might think of as, you know, your sort of typical Red Wall voter, tend to be slightly older, feel overlooked by elites and that their communities have been allowed to decline. Traditional conservatives, probably the easiest one because it does what it says on the tin, economically right-leaning, socially conservative, sceptical of change, actually the smallest of the groups, just 8% in that group. And then finally, a group we call the dissenting disruptors. This is a group who are deeply unhappy with the status quo. If rooted patriots feel overlooked by elites, dissenting disruptors feel actively disparaged. They are powering reforms charge. They're much less comfortable with the idea of multicultural Britain. There's a core of that group, probably about, so they're about 20% of the population. Of that 20%, about a quarter, so 5%, fundamentally not committed to democratic norms. You know, they're right. The group who say that you should use violence. But the other 15% are committed, but just very unhappy with the status quo.
So can you approximate some of these people by geographical location? So maybe we can start to see a breakdown as to maybe some of our viewers, which part of the country they might find themselves in.
Yeah, so it's a really good question. And we're just in the process actually of producing bookmarks for each constituency, which show the proportion in each. So you get all of them everywhere, but obviously there are trends. So progressive activists you would tend to find in big cities, university towns. The established liberals do map onto what's become known as the blue wall. So if you think Oxfordshire, that's established liberal central. Groups like the Rooted Patriots, much more coastal, you know, some of those, you know, former tourist towns that have declined.
So those are the type of constituencies which are like bellwethers. They tend to vote
exactly.
Whoever wins.
So, right. So think of Scarborough and Whitby, which has been long.
But now they're bellwethers, less so between the Tories and Labour, but it seems more so between Reform and Labour. Would that be a fair assumption?
I think that's totally fair. And the interesting thing about the Rooted Patriots is they are a group who only 18% of them went Reform at the last election. So, you know, higher than their average, but less than you might think for a socially conservative group, because they're quite a risk averse segment. Yeah, you know, the dissenting disruptors are like, yeah,
fuck
tear it all down. Yeah. Whereas the Rooted Patriots are much more, I want change, but I'm a bit nervous. They're really worried about things like hate speech, for instance.
Right.
They're now the group where Reform are making big gains because they're going, well, look, Reform might be a risk, but what we've got at the moment isn't working. And so that's
fascinating.
That's it. Traditional conservatives in the shires, dissenting disruptors you would find particularly in sort of post-industrial towns.
Is that the Red Wall, Middle England?
Yeah, it's a bit of the Red Wall. Yeah, exactly. And places that have really suffered the impacts of deindustrialisation.
See, I find it interesting because I grew up in one of those areas. I stood for Parliament in a coastal area against those kind of now Tory swing Reform voters. And I live in London around these progressive activists. And now
you've
I'm
seen
able to
every
get a
segment.
You're like that. That sort of what is that fantasy series about the different segments? People, is it Divergent?
Yeah. You're Divergent. Yeah. You are Divergent.
So I get it all, but I can see. I mean, I find it interesting because I can see how this sense of broken Britain, of shattered Britain, is really coming across. Because when I go back home, I can see a sense of decline that is in the mood and the atmosphere of people. And then I kind of chart my experience back to, 18 months ago, where I could sense that on the doorsteps and why people wanted such radical change in a right-wing way. And then I live in London and people are so disgruntled by the fact that seemingly a progressive, left-wing, social democratic government isn't doing all the things that they want. So I completely understand how it creates a picture that something is not happening in the country and there is a general mood against what is currently going on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the reason that we called it Shattered Britain, which, you know, is a pretty stark
title.
We did it for three reasons. One, because of that sense of fragmentation. Secondly, because if you ask Britons to describe the country in a word, now the word they're most likely to use is broken. And thirdly, that very British definition of shattered,
exhausted.
Because Britain's, you know, and I think that is a big thing which is underplayed. Like, for too many people, you know, people we speak to day in day out, life has just become too hard, right? It's too much of a struggle. We spoke to someone in Runcorn the day after the by-election. She was a woman in her late 50s who said, I thought I'd be slowing down now. I'm still doing shift work. And day to day, it feels like I'm not living. I'm just surviving. And she's not alone, right? She, you know, so many of the people we spoke to for that report had that same view. And I think until we can tackle that, until life just feels a bit easier, it's going to be very hard to repair that sense Britain is shattered.
I've done a bit of crunching around your numbers. You released these incredible graphs that looked at every segment and then the distribution of which parties are performing well where. And it seemed that Labour's got a new base in some ways, right? Like, we were straddling progressive activists, which were once the kind of main base of the party under the Corbyn years, which has now declined, but we're still there. We're still showing up about a third. We've got these incrementalist lefts who are probably a little less impatient, but do want to see progressive change. We've also got these established liberal types as well, which we're doing really well with. The way I kind of read that was actually the more dominant part of Labour's base are people who are pro-system, not anti-system. But the actual numbers of people who are anti-system now seems to be dwarfing those who are pro-system. I mean, this seems to be quite an interesting calculation for Labour as they look forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head. Like, the fact that Labour is down in their vote share since the election in all of our segments, apart from the established Liberals, says something quite profound, right? You would not expect that. And it is because, as you say, Labour have become seen as embodying, you know, the system, making change through existing institutions. And I guess what that means is the big challenge for Labour and this government is to genuinely show that government as it is can be a force for good in people's lives. Otherwise, that anti-system sentiment is just going to overwhelm it as people go, this isn't working. And it, you know, it's kind of like, I don't want to get too deep, but it is kind of ironic that Labour has become seen as like the sort of pro-system
establishment
party in a way that you just wouldn't have expected before.
I mean, it's an interesting pivot, but is there something a bit deeper that's representing about how Labour have tried to prosecute their argument politically? For instance, Labour came in and said, we were going to change some stuff, we're going to tweak some stuff, but it didn't say something about politics being kind of rotten to its core. And that seems to be an emotion that really is rising through people who are dissenting disruptors to skeptical scrollers. That's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it? I mean, it's just fascinating to me that the insurgency right now is around insurgency itself, right? This idea that we need to break things and tear it down. And I worry that the momentum is with that side of politics, not with what we're presiding over.
And I think I would add to that, when Keir Starmer came in and gave that Rose Garden speech, which he himself now acknowledges was a bit of a mistake, it sent a message to lots of people, oh, this really is just more of the same. It's going to be more tough choices, more of what we kicked the last lot out for because we were bored of, well, not just bored of it, furious at it. And it's going to carry on. And I think that is the danger for Labour. And so they've got to, the flip side is, there was that period that you and listeners will remember about 3 months ago when it was like, oh no, Labour's going to do their own versions of the Malay chainsaw thing. And that didn't feel authentic either, right? So there's an interesting thing about how can Labour tap into dissatisfaction with the status quo, but in a way which feels real.
Do you think, so things like that where Keir Starmer's in the Rose Garden and he's saying things are going to be tough, things are going to be hard for a couple of more years, does that set the tone for a government? I mean, you've seen the Tory party effectively reinvent itself over 14 years, and the country has re-elected it on a whole range of coalitions over that period of time. Do you think there is something that the Labour Party can get itself back out of, or does that set the tone? And what are the politics that are needed to ensure that that is possible?
Look, I think the good thing for Labour is that same electoral volatility, which has seen us move into a 5, maybe 6-party system, means that things could snap back as well. You know, voters are more responsive than they have been at points in the past. But you've got to give them something to respond to. Part of it is around boldness in some areas, not being seen like a defender of the status quo, but again, doing it in a way which seems authentic. And I think the one area where Labour could do that is rather than, there's a danger with some of the messaging from Number 10 that the green transition and climate change is, oh, it's something that we've got to do, but actually, you know, it's a bit of a pain and we're worried about what it will do. Actually, if you look at the way Ed Miliband talks about it, I actually think he's one of Labour's better communicators at the moment. He talks about the potential in terms of jobs, in terms of revitalization of post-industrial communities, in terms of energy security. And actually, you could use something like the transition as a mantra to sort of hang your government off. Not in a, you know, I'm not, you know, advocating a sort of, you know, radical, we must degrowth the economy, that sort of thing. Yeah. It's almost the opposite. It's embracing potential. Have something to hook it off, because otherwise you're constantly playing defence. And I think one of the things that was missed at the last election was if you asked Labour and Lib Dem voters, who track each other very closely these days, their top three priorities for government. Number one, cost of living. Number two, NHS, you'd expect. Number three was climate and the environment. And I think making that into a real offer is a way to keep that Labour coalition together and show like you're delivering change.
The other side of that ledger, though, is your skeptical scroller who's saying that net zero is a fad. He's saying that it's a conspiracy theory. I mean, the growth of these sorts of people who live online, who are essentially getting all their news from propaganda or even misinformation, who can capitalize on that voter? And is anyone actually trying to activate this non-voter who could completely shift our electoral system?
I think it's the sort of million-dollar question, right? Because we say in the report, you know, in many ways, Britain today has lots of parallels to the sort of malaise we were experiencing in the 70s. You know, you have that sort of dire public mood, crisis. Lots going, exactly, all of that. The difference is, though, we at least had a shared information source. You know, most people were reading the papers or watching the BBC. Now it's like we're in the 70s, but with information fragmentation, which makes it much harder. And there is that desire. You know, it's interesting, that skeptical scroller segment, when you do focus groups with them, as we did when writing the report. You know, people saying, well, you know, I gave up the best of my time at university to be in lockdown during the pandemic. And then I found out politicians were having parties or giving contracts in a way that they shouldn't have done. So why do you expect me to believe the mainstream now? You know, so part of it is I can understand why there's this level of distrust. But the danger then is that bleeds into all sorts of things. So if you ask about vaccines, the skeptical scroll is now much less likely to say vaccines do more good than harm. And that's a problem. I don't think there is necessarily one person who benefits, but there is a clear loser, which is mainstream politics, because you that fragmentation
really gets picked up by the fringes at that point.
Exactly. And people, you know, are I'm very boring. Most of the reels I watch are cat videos, but other people are watching stuff and going down rabbit holes, which take them into,
don't worry, we're not going to look at your explore page, Luke. We'll leave it to you, brother. But yeah, I mean, look, this is an interesting thing, isn't it, about how protest votes kind of fit into this context. Like the idea of someone voting to make a statement, which is that I don't believe in this thing. And you've looked specifically at people who want to burn down the system, right? And that's quite a wide variety of views and backgrounds, etc. But it does to me seem like something that reform can kind of lean into with a raised eyebrow and a nudge here and there to mobilize probably some voters who in previous times would have just never voted.
But also the left, I think, it goes both ways, it seems to me. I mean, I come across so many disgruntled lefties who want to burn the whole system, as much as there are so many potential reform voters and quite erudite but angry people who also want the system to completely collapse as well. So,
look, I think there is no doubt that the unhappiness with the status quo is feeding this burn it all down sentiment. And what you find is people basically, you know, think 2016 voted for change with Brexit. 2017, that Corbyn surge, lots of people vote for change. 2019, Red Wall, Boris Johnson vote for change. 2024, Keir vote for change. And people go, look, we keep on pressing this change red button. I sort of imagine it in my head as like one of those red ejector buttons yeah, in a sci-fi show. So they keep pressing it and nothing's happening. So clearly it's the wiring and the systems that aren't working rather than just pressing the button. And when you're in a situation where, I think in this week's poll, the more in common poll had Labour and the Tories on 43% between them. I mean, that's extraordinary, right? Like 2 in 5 for the two big parties. And as you say, it is on the one hand driving sentiment on the sort of pop right, so driving people to reform, but other people saying, well, you know, actually the solutions lie on the populist left as well. And it's really, where do you see that split most starkly amongst Gen Z? Where if you look at, you know, we often talk about the fact there is a substantial chunk, although they're still more likely to vote Labour, of Gen Z men who have gone to reform, and that gets a lot of focus. There's much less focus on the massive chunk of Gen Z women who have gone to the Greens. And actually, our politics, and that is not just a trend in the UK, as you will know, that is a trend around the world where young men and young women are going like this, and, you know, goodness knows what that means for our not just politics, society going forward.
But that's one of the reasons that we do this podcast, is we're trying to make sense specifically of that polarization
kind of
question.
Absolutely. I mean, during the 20th century, you could see kind of a sharp line between the workers and the bosses. And there was quite a clear distinguish between capitalism, quote unquote, and socialism. The Labour Party was the kind of democratic socialist party. The Tories embraced kind of established capital in this country. That has completely gone out the window. And you've got people who are becoming socially mobile, but who don't have the same kind of assets as their parents, who may have been ordinary working class people, but can own their own homes. There'll be people who are staring down the long arm of climate change. There are people who are being inspired by a whole range of characters around the world. Do you think it's more of a crisis of capitalism?
I think it's partly that our structures and our political system are finding it difficult to adapt to this later stage of capitalism. I mean, later stage, not in the sort of Marxist analysis.
I mean, just, you know, the
latest iteration, which, whereas, as you say, you don't have these neat divides. I mean, it might have been the case that had we done our segmentation in the 1950s, we'd have found two segments, right? The idea of, let's take one concept, you know, the idea of like class privilege or something, has almost totally broken down, because I, you know, can do a focus group with someone who has gone to an elite university, has become a criminal barrister, and yet they're still in their 30s in a house share with four other people. They can't go on holiday like they planned because they've just had their phone nicked and they need to replace that. They're having a totally miserable time. You've then got people that you would traditionally have thought of as, you know, more working class, struggling, but actually they own their own home outright. They've got much better security. So the contours are just so different. I mean, it's undoubtedly the case, though, that I do think when it comes to politics, less so than the US, but not that much so that sort of formal education level is becoming, you know, pretty defining for people. And so if you look at non-graduates, much more likely to vote Reform, graduates more likely to vote for the Labour Party. And also, the link with life satisfaction. It's so, we did a chart recently which mapped vote share by life satisfaction. And what you saw was the Tories and Labour performing best with the people with the highest life satisfaction. Happiest with the
pro system.
Yeah, Reform and the Greens performing better with those with the lowest life satisfaction.
That's fascinating. And especially the what you said about, you know, young women are moving left. This growth of the left flank of Labour, you know, skewering us potentially at the next election. I read somewhere it was about 3 or 4 to 1. We're losing voters to the left compared to the right to Reform. We see our role a bit as like, can you unite the left? I mean, not very easy as we're finding out.
I mean, it's hard to get a name, is let alone anything else.
But I wonder whether, this is a little theory I'm kind of throwing about, and I want to hear what you think about it. But I would argue that a lot of left discourse or political left discourse followed a lot of these young women who've moved green. But that kind of vacated space, I would argue, for right of that, and for men. And so men of that generation, perhaps reactively, were like, well, you've got this view of the world that you're, that caters for you and you feel really strongly about, but that's not really me and I don't see where I fit into it. Do you think that that's plausible as what's driving some of this polarization?
I think it's definitely part of it. I mean, there is no doubt that, you know, we've done some particular focus group work with young men. It's important not to generalize, but there's definitely a group of young men who think the system no longer works for people like me anymore. And we've essentially been told that, you know, masculinity is a bad thing, and obviously got the growing education gaps in terms of formal education between men and women, and it's just not really working. And as we have seen, let's not just look at the UK, let's look at the US, the sort of more populist right is able to offer or seemingly offer an answer to that. So for some it is, you know, a new future, for others it's turning the clock back as well. And, you know, one of the things which I found most worrying in some of our recent poll data was we were asking around Me Too and the Me Too movement. And, you know, the is it a good thing that there is greater attention paid to violence or assault against women? And, you know, most people agree, but there's a substantial chunk of young men who say that the bigger risk now is false allegations against young men rather than real allegations against women, which I find like sort of baffling. But clearly something is in there. And, you know, that can then be stirred up by, you know, parties who want to exploit that, but even beyond parties. And we know actually the role of some influencers in the manosphere are preying on that sort of attitude.
And you see how this feeds back into your segmentation around people who distrust the system. So all of those people are conspiracy thinkers. All of them are trying to attack, you know, traditional institutions who have...
They want to break it down.
Exactly, who have a monopoly on truth. They don't want people to buy into that stuff, and then they will take advantage of the insecurity that these young men have, which are actually really like economic questions. But I don't want to justify the nonsense of like young men being able to empathize with women. This is a massive problem and we need to take accountability for it. But it is really striking, I think, that people, some operators politically, see that as an opportunity.
Absolutely.
And how we combat that, I think, is like a really important open question for how you build like a political movement around that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to what we were saying. I think some of these things are as much sociological as they are economic or political or ideological. In a case of shattered Britain, what are the pieces that we need to kind of pick up and put back together? Is it having these challenging conversations, which they're absolutely essential?
And I think there are multiple levels on it. I think mixing and connection is clearly hugely important, and creating opportunities for that in a world where, you know, I often talk about not far from where you grew up in Dudley, I did a focus group with and there was a crane driver who was called Clive, who said before the pandemic, we all used to have lunch together on the construction site. Since then, we all eat in our cars. And then everyone in the focus group piped up with a story about how they'd retreated inwards. And of course, when you're doing that, it means that, you know, you're not mixing with other people, you're not getting to understand other people. But also, I think there's a deeper thing. And this is, I want to do more research on this, so it's just a theory at the moment. But part of what I think is leading to this rise in conspiracy thinking is previously you might have had, let's take a more benign one, that the moon landings were faked. You know, you go to the pub, you say that, and your mates will, oh, come off it. You know, it's nonsense. Now, of course, you don't do that. You go and find the Twitter feed or the reel or what I'm getting all the words wrong, but you know, whatever it is, the influencer who believes it, and then your algorithm pumps more into it. And so rather than socialization acting as a disruptor for conspiracy thinking, it's actively reinforcing it as well. So I think that is a huge part. But I also think, look, for me, one of the central tests is about agency, right? People want to feel in control of their lives. It's why Take Back Control, whatever you think of Brexit, was a genius slogan. And at the moment, they don't think they're in control because, you know, they're like, what on earth is the next energy bill going to be? What's the next one? They don't think the government's in control. You know, they're thinking, they can't get me a GP appointment. They keep promising to stop the boats. They don't. You know? And then internationally, you've got what is that madman, well, either in the Kremlin or in the White House, going to do next, is what people will say in focus groups. So you've got that level of lack of control. So I think finding ways to give people back control is going to be so important. And my fear is, not to be too much of a doom monger, I'm sure I just go on these things and depress people these days. I'm trying not to, but my fear is that AI is going to accelerate that lack of agency and control. And I think we need to be doing more thinking now, which we didn't do in the last technological industrial revolution with deindustrialization and globalization, about how we handle this and give people agency. We need to be doing that with AI.
I completely agree in terms of that agency point and control. But then what voters see of politics is increasing fragmentation, right? So that agency question about the people in charge kind of goes out the window, and it reinforces that sense of doubt. Look, we've got a new left party that have emerged. How are you understanding what that kind of vote share is going to look like for the Jeremy Corbyn, Zara Sultana, your party, whatever name they come up with, party, whatever they're going to do? Like, what is, because I'm reading that as a Labour person as, this is great news for reform, because if you have something skewering the left, it's exactly the same as 2024 for the right. And that's what handed us a win. So, I mean, we're really handing over the impetus to the other side.
And then I see that as a regretful situation that the Labour Party can't accommodate a broad enough family where people like myself and so many other people who have legitimate concerns about the state of the country, who want a left-wing response, feel as though that is the answer. I mean, there's this undue pressure on kind of progressives to kind of go with your head over your heart, but I think it's your heart that's going to change the country. So I just find it really regretful that the Labour Party hasn't found a big enough kind of tent to accommodate what the left is.
Well, yeah, I mean, parties that look split rarely do well. And if you look back over our, to go back to the segment, the parties that have won are the parties that have won four or five of them, right? Like, you need that type of coalition. You need to accommodate, you know, and it's the same lesson for the Conservatives as well, that, you know, they need to win back some reform voters, but they also need to win back voters they lost to Labour and the Liberal Democrats if they're to have a chance. And there's a tendency to focus on one wing or the other. In terms of how the Corbyn party might perform, we did some hypothetical polling on this about a month ago, and, you know, caveat hypothetical polling, you know, Anna Soubry might be Prime Minister of a Change UK led thing, you know, it has its limits, but it gives us an idea of the starting point. So we found that it would take 10% of the vote in
of Labour's vote.
No, 10% of the vote overall. So 10% overall. Of that, around 3 points came from Labour, around 4 from the Greens, and the rest from elsewhere. And what that did was it grew Reform's lead in that poll from 4 to 7. So definitely helped Reform, hurt the Greens even more. And I think part of that is because, you know, they're playing in the same pool, and I'm sure we'll hear conversations about a deal and different seats. But also, you know, I've heard people say, I'm surprised it only takes 3 points off Labour. That forgets that since the election, Labour have actually lost a load of progressive votes already. In fact, in the report, we estimate that Labour have lost around 1 million progressive votes since the election. So the pool to, you know, when you're down on 24%, there's not actually that much more left to lose. So it would definitely have an impact. And bear in mind how small margins are in elections at the moment. So I think, yeah, it's not for me to give strategic advice to anyone, but, you know, I think building a big tent is the way for political parties to succeed. And I guess I sometimes wonder if there is, to your head and heart point, whether there is too much riding on in Labour strategy circles. The next election is going to be a choice between PM Starmer, or whoever's leading Labour Party, and PM Farage, and the left will have to sort of suck it up and come back. But, you know, that only works so many times. We've seen other, you know, in other countries where it hasn't worked.
France is a good example of that, right? And then, so I mean, even if we did win, then how do you unite that front to another parliament, right? So this is why we're thinking you've got to figure out this big tent problem. We need to restructure our ideological mission probably and bring some heart back into it to then unify and make people think, all right, that what's happened has happened, but how do we look forward in the right way? I mean, spare a thought for Zach Polanski, man. Like, he must be feeling gutted. You come in on this thing about being a left populist. I think it makes loads of sense. It's the right time. And then you get overshadowed by, I guess, the old progenitor and then this kind of new face of it. And I know they're talking about doing this kind of pact, but it just seems a bit odd for the kind of left flank, which is only about, what, 10% of the electorate? And even then, it's a proportion of that 10% being split into different parts of places. It feeds that narrative of the left can't really figure out or organise itself to be...
That Monty Python joke, isn't it, about the People's Judean Front and the Judean...
Yeah, exactly.
So we're rehashing old stories, right? But this is the thing, is that how do we bring these people back together is something that I'm not sure Number 10 are necessarily worrying about right now. But the thing you said about PM Farage versus PM Starmer, I guess this is the one thing that Labour people might be happy to hear, is that that's question that still comes out quite nicely for us.
It does. And voters on the left are more likely to say they would vote tactically, although we're detecting in some of the latest polling a little bit less willingness from Green voters to say that they would come back. So I think it's got its limits. But I just want to go into use it, you know, that thing about heart and purpose and mission. And I think, again, for all politics, I think people have learned some of the wrong lessons from 2019 and Jeremy Corbyn, in the sense that we have to be totally non-ideological. You know, the government, you know, Starmer makes a virtue out of not having Starmerism. And you don't have to have Starmerism, but people do have to know what you're about. People do have to know whose side you're on. So when we ask people who is benefiting the most for this government, or who are they most helping, it is big businesses, the rich, and immigrants come out as the top three that people say they're helping. When we ask who is suffering the most, it is pensioners and the working class.
Which come out.
And when you're a Labour government, right, you really don't want that, you know. And so I think
definitely not ultra rich big business.
It's not what I think part of that is, and again, when we talk to people, I don't understand Starmer. I don't know what he's about. And it then unfairly, I think, makes him look shifty. And they say, oh, you know, he just was going to come in and take away pensioners' winter fuel allowance or do this on welfare. But because they don't have that. And look, delivery matters the most, first and foremost, but you've got to have a story with it. And we've done some work with UCL Policy Lab, who I think, you know, and Mark Steers, around the idea of respect. And we think there's a really powerful frame around respect. Too many people feel like their contribution isn't respected at the moment. And actually, the opportunity there is to think about a new politics of respect, which Starmer talked about before the election, but hasn't...
How do you actualise that? That is the question.
Yeah. We talk a lot about a new social contract, don't we? And about this idea that people need to give in, feel like they're giving in and getting out. And that's something that's been lost. I mean, the government are running this very difficult tightrope, though, because when they try and do things that I think broadly people in the political bubble would say is smart to do for the economy, it then goes down like a sack of sick, right? Like, when you have this one image of, like, what's one thing that Labour have got wrong, and it literally just is winter fuel allowance. It's just like, it's front and centre. Look, we've spoken about this before on the podcast. This is the problem about communication, really, isn't it? Like, we just didn't find a way to be able to get past the gatekeepers of information of the media, who knew that it was going to be a stick to beat us with. But there's also a bit of a problem on the public's perspective about, like, how do you let government do these things that everyone else is basically saying kind of needs to happen?
Yeah, and I think, look, I think politicians have to take the blame there as well. So when you ask the public, what would you like, you know, higher or lower taxes, more or less public spending? They want both low taxes and higher public spending. But then when you add the third option, which is reducing waste, the public think you can do all of it or a significant amount through reducing waste. And I think it's around half the public think that 15% of government spending could be cut tomorrow without any impact on public services or the economy. So it's not the public being cakeists, it's because politicians of all parties have gone on and on about waste and convinced people that there aren't these hard choices. And I think the thing with the winter fuel allowance, because, you know, back it was a couple of things that if you ask people should millionaires be getting the winter fuel allowance, most people say no. But then having the cutoff at 12,000 was like, there were people saying, well, you know, I'm barely getting by as it is. And so what worries me is that the lesson that will be read from that debate is we can never do this tough stuff. And it's not that. It's do pitch rolling, make sure you get the cutoffs right and don't look like you're not rewarding contribution. And, you know, tell a story as part of it.
I think it's alongside a lack of a kind of bold agenda. I mean, for me, what the Labour government could have started with doing is unpicking all of the kind of Tory bits of legislation or all of the kind of infrastructure that has, I think, dogged this country over the last 40 years around, I mean, I go on about it a lot, but things around like the Bank of England and the OBR, the ECHR, the Supreme Court of Justice, all of these kind of fundamental questions that add just a level of bureaucracy into people's lives. So it just makes it so much more difficult to hold accountable the people in office. That would have been a good start for me. I think abolishing NHS England was probably one of the best things this government could have done because it shows we're willing to strip out a layer of middle management. That could have been taken across the board and people would have had a sense that politicians have control of this country, so they're not just responding. It feels as though, I don't know, does this come across in your focus groups where the government is largely responding to the day's events rather than dictating what is going on?
It's that control point entirely, right? The government's not in control. It's told what to do by, you know, NHS England or whichever other institution. I think you're absolutely right that getting the state working again requires thinking about rewiring, well, not just rewiring, you know, tearing it all out, putting it back in much more radically. But it's interesting, there would be, I think it would be quite rare for me to come on a podcast with a sort of left-wing bent and people would be talking about the Supreme Court and or the European Court of Human Rights because people go, you're just playing into the hands of populists. But do you know what I mean? I mean, there's the sort of the discussions and guardrails about like how politicians take back control, again, is one of the most fundamental, I think, debates. But I would also say, and this I do think is, you know, I feel slightly sorry for the government for, is when you ask about a whole raft of other policies, so workers' rights, renters' rights, the sewage stuff, Great British Energy.
Come on, keep listening.
You know, I mean, I could, you know, minimum wage.
Yeah.
Hugely popular, but they have been drowned out by what I sort of call the quadrant of doom policies, which is winter fuel, disability benefits, national insurance on small business, and the prisoner releases as well. And like in the last case, you know, sort of like the government had very limited room for maneuver. They inherited a legacy, but they have just had much more than this sort of, you know, the stuff Angela Rayner, Steve Reed, Ed Miliband's doing actually is popular. And so how do you make more of that? And so it's retail, right?
Yeah, spot on. We have to communicate our wins properly. People need to know. So I think that's a good way to wrap up this first section of the discussion. We'll be back after a break. There's been a lot of chatter this week about civil unrest. I'm sure you've seen it. I imagine that by the time this episode goes out, the summer potentially of discontent has either happened or not happened.
Let's hope not happened,
but it has been talked about as if it is going to happen. Do you share that same view? I mean, look, viewers are going to be able to judge you whether you're right or wrong, so I understand if you might want to be agnostic about this. But Shattered Britain speaks to this idea that we are about to face some serious civil disobedience.
Well, I would urge a bit of caution on that. I mean, there's no doubt, again, when you ask the public, they are very worried that we will see a rise in civil disobedience. But and the fact that any civil disobedience takes place, I think, should be a cause for concern. But we should remember that the people actively involved in this stuff, we're talking about in the thousands rather than representing, a bigger chunk. But, you know, it's still worrying. And we've tried to, when the riots happened last year, we did a bit of a sort of look at how widely held some of those attitudes were. And what we found was, you could broadly think of it sort of almost like Russian dolls, people's attitudes. So you've got a hardcore, it's around 7% maybe, who say, I'm ashamed that Britain's a multi-ethnic country, who say it's appropriate to use violence protesting outside an asylum hotel. So
yeah, those are our listeners, by the way. Yeah.
But, you know, it's a small group, but not into, you know, enough to be worrying. You've then got another group who are around 20% who sort of say, well, I condemn violence, but I understand what people are protesting about, and you know their views are right. You've then got another group, and this is where you get to sort of 50-60% who say, I don't like asylum hotels, but I've got no truck with anything that's going on there. And then you've got an even bigger group, which is like, we're really worried about community cohesion and what this means for our community. So that's broadly there. But again, it's, I think we've got to be really careful that with some of the, you know, on the civil disobedience of, look, there are clearly some people for whom, you know, on the far right agitators want to sort of, you know, talk us into a situation where there is civil disobedience. And I think you've got to be a bit careful about seeing it as an inevitability, because again, to go back to what we were talking about before, obviously it's bad in of itself, it's particularly bad for the communities affected, but also it plays into that sense of powerlessness, government not in control. It's like, well, the government keeps telling us they're worried about riots, but they can't stop them. Yeah.
Which makes Farage's comments even more interesting, right? This thing of, I think it's going to happen, obviously I'm really upset that it's going to happen, I mean, take that with a pinch of salt. If it were to happen, that's good for Farage.
Well, certainly the sense that the social fabric is fracturing and we need something different is good for Farage. But it's worth saying that last year's riots were not good for Reform UK. And, you know, look, there were lots of, you know, we're still bearing the scars of those riots, I think, and lots of communities, lots of negatives that came out of it. But voters took quite a dim view of Nigel Farage's comments at the time. And actually, it was one of the things which people most approved of Keir Starmer for his reaction. It's slightly gotten lost in what's happened since. So I wouldn't necessarily say that it is a benefit for Farage. I think it is those people who aren't in politics to Farage's right, you know, the sort of far right of politics, who are particularly trying to sort of capitalise on this. But it is a difficult situation. Look, I think we can have no problem in saying that you could be someone who thinks Britain does have a responsibility to protect the vulnerable and provide refuge to those genuinely in need, and to say the asylum hotels policy has been a disaster for community cohesion. And I think, you know, lots of people can hold both of those views.
And I guess that's, we've had a conversation about this quite a lot around integration, community cohesion, which seems to be, I mean, immigration is kind of the subject of the day. It's the kind of never-ending conversation that politicians, journalists always want to talk about. But there doesn't seem to be a kind of coherent conversation outside of just a set of demonising of quite vulnerable people who are coming over here, who are being exploited. There doesn't seem to be a conversation around cohesion.
Immigration is one of the bigger dividing lines now in our politics. I mean, not necessarily in a sort of more or less immigration. I actually think, you know, most groups, I think, apart from the progressive activists now, think that the levels of immigration, I think most people accept that a million people was too high in the last government. But I think you're entirely right to focus on that integration piece, and it is something the British public place a real premium on. You know, it's around 7 in 10 say we need to do more on integration. But interestingly, they also say that integration shouldn't just be the responsibility of people from minority communities, that is something that we all have to do and take part in. And, you know, that to my mind, and this is my view rather than based on the public opinion research, but I think, you know, it carries a lot of truck with people. Things like English language are just so important, you know, because they matter for participating in society. They matter for that sense of, you know, commonality. It's also empowering to people from minority communities and disempowering if they can't interact with people around them. So, you know, things there, we should be looking at opportunities for greater social mixing, particularly in education, there in my old line of work. And then I think you can then go, you know, I hate this language, but I think you can then go tougher on some of the other stuff where there is deliberate segregation. So, for instance, around unregistered schools where children are not being, you know, taught a broad and balanced curriculum and often are getting a purely religious education. You can go to that, but you've got to have something on the other side, which is we are going to make it easier for people to integrate and mix with one another.
Absolutely. And I think I take umbrage a little bit with that idea that it doesn't fall on anyone. It's all our responsibility. And as an ethnic minority person, like two of us, we both are like, if no one else is going to do it, then why are we going to sit on our asses? Like, we need to fix this social integration problem. We are two examples right here that social integration works, that it can work, right? That's, we're British people. It's not about being white. It's not the only way to describe Britishness, as much as the populist right and that certain commentators online want to frame it as such, right? We believe in a united Britain. And unless we start to do something about that, we will get something much more demagoguery, like so much more worrying and so much more distasteful. We have to do something.
Totally. And there has been, I think, an assumption for a long time that social cohesion is just either this thing that happens, or what it means is, you know, getting people together to sort of sing Kumbaya, and, you know, or it's, you know, engaging, you know, it happens at the level of, oh, we'll do a round table with community leaders.
So patronizing.
And it doesn't build the stronger social fabric we need. And I think one of the great sadnesses and cautionary points, now obviously, like, you know, what is happening in Gaza at the moment is appalling and distressing, but let's also look at the impact that October 7th and beyond has had on community relations at home. Yeah. Actually, some of the relations we thought were much stronger have frayed quite quickly. And I think that should be a warning that, you know, we need to be resilient here at home as well.
Yeah, it's right that you bring up Gaza. It's something that I think, as two people who still support the Labour Party, find really, really hard.
Harrowing.
Like, where do we go when you can see on this international scale this huge disorder that leads to innocent people losing their lives? I mean, the Daily Express came out. Killing. Do you know what I mean? It just shows you that
strategic killing of innocent people, as far as I'm concerned. And it's been going on for so long. And foreign policy seems now to be a bit of a driver in domestic politics. I mean, we can see that around particular communities, kind of Hindus and Muslims in some parts of the country. How, again, could that play out at the next election?
It's interesting that we have done a lot of work speaking to particularly Muslim voters in areas that voted for the so-called Gaza independence. And one of the things which I've taken away from those conversations is that Gaza has acted as the trigger for that rift and that split from the Labour Party. But it's not by no means the sole cause. And I've actually made the comparison that actually it feels similar to how Brexit felt for Red Wall voters. It was that moment when people thought, I'm being taken for granted by Labour and I'm going to go elsewhere. And even when Brexit is done, people who move back. Similar Gaza for lots of Muslim voters who say, Labour's taken me for granted. They haven't invested in my community.
Tokenizing.
You know, almost exactly the same conversations I would hear in the Red Wall. I would hear in inner city. But there's just this thread there. So you've got that. That element, which Labour, well, if they want to be re-elected, will have to address. You've then, as you say, got the impact of other international conflicts playing out. So Leicester, which was, you know, at one point held up as an example of multiculturalism working, the tension there between Muslim and Hindu residents of the city. And then you've got it playing out in politics there with Hindu voters swinging much more to the Conservatives. You know, Leicester East, the only Conservative gained. Admittedly, there was a split vote there, but Bob Blackman in Harrow East
increased his majority.
It's now the second safest Tory seat in the country or something.
I think there's something really interesting about saying that Muslim communities were speaking the same language as these Red Wall Brexit voters who are probably looking at voting for reform now. And that, to me, speaks to a political economy problem, right? There's something more broad about the way our society is set up, that you have people in often urban or even deindustrialized communities who have basically been forgotten about, essentially describing the same issue of politics does not work for me. And they know that because their material life has not improved at all over the last 15, 20 years, which makes me think that actually the fragmentation we're seeing within our systems now, with the number of political parties, the number of different voters, that is representative of a system that just doesn't work anymore. And maybe there is something on the side of the insurgents when they're saying that we need to not necessarily burn down, but really need to reform these institutions. I mean, what historically do we have to go off, you know, in terms of the electorate being split into seven different things, with actually about seven different parties now as well?
Yeah, well, it's difficult to think of a similar parallel. I mean, I guess the last time that you had an emergent party? I mean, obviously in the 80s you had the Alliance, and at some point they were at 50% in the polls and then they dropped back. And we shouldn't write off the idea that maybe come 2029 we're talking about a straight Tory Labour race again. Could be. Obviously in the 20s you had a Labour replacing the Liberals, and that was a time of transition there as well, so you've definitely got that. But the truth is, if you look at our politics today, look at one of our look at our latest poll which came out, which was I think Reform 29, maybe Labour 22, Tories 20, Lib Dems 15. Take out the party names and the country and show that to someone 5 years ago, and they'll be like, oh, this is a poll from Germany, or this is a poll from a European country with PR. And we are beginning to look much more like that type of system than and first past the post cannot cope. It just cannot cope with this many parties, and you are going to see, you know, in our latest MRP, which is a way of projecting individual seats, we had 100 seats that would be won on under 30% of the vote.
That's crazy.
But this time, the Mayor of the West of England elected with 25% of the vote. You know, that is...
I mean, even still, 33% of a 60% turnout for the last government to wield so much power is still, to me, emblematic of something starting to go wrong, that so few people voted for a government and we've got as many seats as we have. And that's not a statement on the party, that's a statement on the system, that it's already starting to creak. And so I think once we get to that point where now with 5, 6, even 7 possible parties at the next election, everything is all to play for, surely. And so that naturally then means that political parties have to make the case to particular demographics of people in order to get the 100, 200, 300 votes to tip them into the House of Commons, surely.
Yeah, I mean, that is the big question is, how does the level of fragmentation play out when it comes to individual seats at the moment? And as I say, it means at the moment, you know, what held Reform back at the last election was the fact that they got 15% more than the Liberal Democrats, but it was so spread out. Once you reach a certain point, that really benefits you as well. But I think it is difficult to see if we end up with, you know, there is a world in which, so we talked about 33%, 60%, you know, the winning margin might be even lower next time, at which point people start to say that this system isn't working. And I think it's held Labour back this time, because what it has meant is, look, I think the public broadly got the outcome they wanted at the last election. But what it meant was them coming in with such a low vote share was they didn't have the normal political capital that a new government has to play with to lose. It meant they came in and, well, yeah, 2/3 of the country is against you. Well, sorry, 2/3 of voters, you know, are against you. Amongst the public as a whole, it's probably even more.
Yeah, and then it makes you think, right, because Reform were pro-proportional representation. Yeah. And now looking, probably licking their lips at the current MRPs and thinking, let's stick to this first part.
Let's leave that stage.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, about how much democratic reform could play a part in this. And this is something that you hear like Rory Stewart and Alistair Campbell talk about a lot. I'm broadly on side in this argument. I don't think our society is functioning because we have such a laissez-faire attitude to politics. I think, in fact, if politics is creeping in and on our lives all the time, then people should be empowered to be more involved in that system. I wonder whether the move to put 16 and 17 year olds to make them vote is a good actually signal on this pro-democratic reform side. It's not actually about, okay, who's going to win or lose. I think that's kind of a bit of a question, because it's about 1.5 million voters. They might not even turn out that much. But I would be more for, like, let's make voting mandatory. Let's say that we work for you.
Well, I mean, look, I
would be against that.
I thought the most radical part of Labour's election reform proposals was not votes of 16, important as that may be. I thought it was the move to automatic voter registration, because that's going to actually have a profound effect in lots of ways. It might not necessarily mean that more people vote, but it does mean at the moment that inner city MPs are representing lots more people than they're being counted for, because they have more voters who aren't registered. You know, the act of getting someone on the register, I think, is quite a powerful one. It also means boundaries will have to be redrawn to take account of that, and that will have a shift too. But I hope to go back to 16 and 17 year olds. My hope is that that sits alongside a proper attempt at looking at civics education in the UK, which we have always neglected but maybe less so, you know, in Scotland. You have things like modern studies, which people have been able to do. But I don't think we've had enough emphasis on that. And I think it would be a missed opportunity to do that. And we should think about it. But also think about how to do it in a way which genuinely informs young people and avoids the risk of, you know, you don't want teachers getting involved in partisan politics.
Yeah. And I think there's been a bit of, like, Labour's doing this cynically because it just helps them. But I'm not really sure that that actually, like, is going to check out when we talk about how there's polarisation amongst Gen Z, when we talk about the volatility of these people, that they mainly get their information off social media as well. I mean, Reform, I think, see an opportunity actually with young people. Do you think that there is much concern anymore in politics about policy, or is it actually more a game of what sounds good, what comes up well, what appears to be good comms?
I definitely think that, you know, comms matter and people expect to be able to, you know, engage with a politician. You know, I did a focus group in Wigan earlier this week, and the three politicians that they talked about, and they talked about them all quite fondly, came from three different parties. It was Andy Burnham from Labour, it was Boris Johnson from the Tories, and it was Nigel Farage from Reform. What have those three got in common? It is, and I asked the group, it was the sense that they're authentic, that they relate, that they... Now, there are countless debates that people get into online about how authentic they really are. But it doesn't matter, right? People think that they are authentic. And I think there's a second bit as well, which is I think people like politicians who look like they're enjoying the job. Again, you know, you look at Boris, you look at Angela Rayner, you know, people tend to quite like, you look at Nigel Farage, I guess. Whereas I think part of the challenge for Starmer is sometimes he just appears slightly pained, like he doesn't want to be there. And actually you sort of saw the same thing with Rishi Sunak, you sort of saw it with Theresa May a little bit. Again, Cameron was one who looked like he enjoyed it. Blair looked like he enjoyed it. Brown, maybe less so. And I do think there is something about enjoyment.
Yeah, you have
there.
To want to do yeah. it. And I think people have to know that that's what you want to do as well. Because otherwise, I mean, why would you have confidence in someone who's begrudgingly taking decisions for the entire country? I think that's largely the sentiment around it. I, again, draw upon my own experiences standing for Parliament. I thoroughly enjoyed the experience. I really enjoyed it. Don't get me wrong, it was really challenging. But yeah, exactly. And I mean...
Why do you win them?
Next time.
I don't know. I just kind of think that is what it's about. Like, democracy is to have life. And I think it's to participate and to engage, but also to do so knowingly and with choice. I mean, that's why I'm probably opposed to mandatory voting and things of that sort. But it's to make it active enough that you want to be involved. Because it's interesting, it's inviting ideas, it's interrogating ideas. And when you've got just boring, quite sterile people who just are at the top and who are just taking quite bland decisions or decisions that don't seem to affect you unless they're in a negative way, then that's when I think the whole system starts to fall apart. It's as much a belief system, I believe it to be, as much as it is a practice of kind of political life in this country.
Can I throw in a curveball there about Farage enjoying it, though? Because I think Farage enjoys being the communicator. I'm not necessarily sure he enjoys the idea of actually being prime minister. And this is something that Matt Torbett, who came on the show, thinks that he's thrown this theory around, that he thinks that Farage wants to be the almost prime minister, because it solidifies his brand, the thing that could have been but didn't quite, because that ultimately it means he doesn't actually have to do this impossibly hard job of delivering a mandate and uniting a very fractious and broken country. Do you think that Nigel really wants it?
I don't know. I mean, I think I think the Nigel Farage of 3 years ago probably didn't want it. And didn't see it as being in sight. I think there's definitely been a shift now, and you have seen what I think is interesting is Farage's willingness to avoid the mistakes his party's made in the past. So, you know, much more discipline on candidates actively and properly trying to appeal in Scotland, which they never successfully did before, pivoting to the left on some economic issues. Again, you know, UKIP was a very sort of libertarian type party. And now he's, you know, which is probably not his politics on lots of stuff. He's pivoting those series. And also, and, you know, look, whatever you think of Farage, I think it is important, like, for the body politic that he has done this, distancing himself from figures like Tommy Robinson as well, putting up those guardrails. And it makes reform different. And I think it's, you know, from a party like the AfD, where clearly there are fewer guards. That doesn't mean there aren't problematic elements, clearly. You know, we saw at the last election there were, but it is of a different thing. And I think part of it is Farage thinks, I could do this now.
From a polling perspective, the way that reform can, even in just their name, do both the kind of boomerism of like changing the country and fixing it and whatever, but also the doomerism of the country's broken. They've kind of got the narrative right for the system
for
that
the time
we are
in.
It does feel like they're very much setting the agenda. But do you think that that comes with actually a burden the closer and closer we get towards an election, perhaps when we have even more reform councils because of what happens in the local elections next year? Do you see that as being a big kind of banana skin for them going forward?
Potentially. I mean, to sort of go back to your question about Farage wanting to become PM, let's assume Farage doesn't become PM and reform don't form a government. Regardless of that, it's hard to argue that over the last decade, he isn't the most significant politician in British politics, from, you know, Brexit, but also from the pressure he put on the Tories at the last election and what he is now doing to Labour. Can they continue to ride the two horses? Maybe, but they've got to start showing, I think, you know, there's a danger that reform end up doing their own version of the Rose Garden speech, right? Which is, oh, it's all going to be even more terrible. They've got to show what the positive is on the other side. And I think there's a danger. Your listeners will remember the Trump 2016 inauguration, 2017 inauguration speech, the American carnage thing. I don't think there is much truck for a sort of British carnage style pitch.
But that's interesting, because you often see reform borrowing policies from the Trump administration. It's like we're like 6 months down, like Doge
just appeared,
anti-net zero. I mean, British people don't want us to be America.
No. And, you know, Donald Trump is deeply unpopular in this country. He's unpopular with the groups that reform need to win over if they're to have a chance of forming a government. The British public, you know, have some questions about the costs of net zero and how it'll be paid for and want it to be fair, but overwhelmingly are worried about climate change. And I think by 2-1 margin, our latest polling support the net zero target. You know, Brits are almost entirely united on questions around, you know, Ukraine. You know, in that segmentation, you know, the traditional conservatives and the progressive activists are the most likely to support Ukraine. You know, that spans right and left. So there are real weaknesses. And, you know, we did some work a couple of months ago, which we called Farage's MAGA Mirage, which is, there's lots of rhyming or alliteration in that, but the idea that Trump is a boon for him is absolutely not. And we have seen in two elections, particularly Canada, where, you know, if you'd asked me this time last year, I would have said there is no way that the
remarkable, isn't it, when you look at the graph?
Canadian Liberals are going to go. Maybe I wouldn't have said no way because I don't do predictions like that. But it was very unlikely. But and in Australia as well, Trump has influenced there. Now, I would urge, I think there are some progressives who are betting too much on the Trump effect sinking Farage. And I would just, but it is no, there is no doubt it is an Achilles heel. It is an anchor on them.
I mean, it's a challenge for us because obviously we're hugging America as well. So, I mean, how anti-Trump could Labour present themselves?
I think it's just getting more and more interesting by the day, where we've seen recently the government now, I mean, on the big issues of the day around Palestine, does it align itself with France and a kind of potentially more European standpoint to global foreign policy? Or does it align itself with Trump, who is completely against what France has done? And I think this could be a bit of a, for all of the horror and cruelty that's going on in the Middle East, this could be one of the biggest wedge issues between differentiating us as kind of America's lapdog or whether we're going to support our kind of European French friends across the seas.
And it was interesting that even under the last Conservative government, there were noises coming from David Cameron when he was Foreign Secretary saying that the UK was going to have to look at a path to recognition of Palestine. And so I think there is, I think that's very definitely a move. The one thing I would say for Starmer is, sometimes the public complain he's, when we talk to him in focus groups, he does too much international stuff, but he has tended to get higher marks from that. So if you remember after the Zelensky Oval Office meeting, when he played the mediator role, we saw his approvals, they're still underwater, but they did shoot up then. And I don't know. I mean, you will have a feel for this as well. He does seem more comfortable doing the international stuff than he necessarily does the domestic politics.
There's like rules there that he understands as opposed to this thing now, which is complete, like, which is a new thing that none of us, we're all trying to make sense of.
Well, yeah, try knocking on a door in the east of England who wants to destroy the entire system is probably a bit harder, I would say.
Yeah, it is a little bit. Well, let's hope that there can be some form of international arrangement that can come together and alleviate some of those horrible scenes that we're seeing every day. We don't know what's happening next, and we're trying to still figure out what is left. But thank you so much, Luke.
Thank you
for enlightening us to the state of the country.
It was so enlightening.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Great.
Thanks.